as efficient as others, are discarded. Iverson paused. But how this organization happens really isn't understood in any depth. Do you know how many neurons it takes to control the first part of a lobster's gut, Neville? Have a guess to the nearest 100. Clavaine shrugged. I don't know. 500? 1,000? No. 6. Not 600. Just 6. 6 damned neurons. You can't get much simpler than that, but it took decades to understand how those 6 worked together, let alone how that particular network evolved. The problems aren't inseparable either. You can't really hope to understand how 10 billion neurons organize themselves into a functioning whole unless you understand how the whole actually functions. Oh, we've made some progress. We can tell you exactly which spinal neurons fire to make a lamprey swim and how that firing pattern maps into muscle motion. But we're a long way from understanding how something as elusive as the concept of I emerges in the developing human mind. Well, at least we were before I went under. You may be about to tell me you've achieved stunning progress in the last century, but something tells me you were too busy with social upheaval for that. Clavaine felt an urge to argue, angered by the man's tone, but suppressed it, willing himself into a state of serene acceptance. You're probably right. We've made progress in the other direction, augmenting the mind as it is, but if we genuinely understood brain development, we wouldn't have ended up with a failure like Felka. Oh, I wouldn't call her a failure, Neville. I didn't mean it like that. Of course not. Now it was Iverson's turn to place a hand on Clavaine's shoulder. But you must see now why I find Felka so fascinating. Her mind is damaged. You told me that yourself, and there's no need to go into the details. But despite that damage, despite the vast abyss in her head, she's beginning to self-assemble the kinds of higher-level neural routines we all take for granted. It's as if the patterns were always there as latent potentials, and it's only now that they're beginning to emerge. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it something worthy of study? Delicately, Clavaine removed the man's hand from his shoulder. I suppose so. I had hoped, however, that there might be something more to it than study. I have offended you, and I apologize. My choice of phrase was poor. Of course I care for her. Clavaine felt suddenly awkward, as if he had misjudged a fundamentally decent man. I understand. Look, ignore what I said. Yeah, of course. It, will be all right for me to see her again, won't it? Clavaine nodded. I'm sure she'd miss you if you weren't around. Over the next few days, Clavaine left the two of them to their games, only rarely eavesdropping to see how things were going. Iverson had asked permission to show Felka around some of the other areas of the base, and after some initial misgivings, Clavaine and Galiana had both agreed to his request. After that, long hours went by when the two of them were not to be found. Clavaine had tracked them once, watching as Iverson led the girl into a disused lab and showed her intricate molecular models. They clearly delighted her, vast, fuzzy, holographic assemblages of atoms and chemical bonds that floated in the air like Chinese dragons. Wearing cumbersome gloves and goggles, Iverson and Felka were able to manipulate the megamolecules, forcing them to fold into minimum energy configurations that brute force computation would have struggled to predict. As they gestured into the air and made the dragons contort and twist, Clavaine watched for the inevitable moment when Felka would grow bored and demand something harder. But it never came. Afterwards, when she had returned to the fold, her face shining with wonder, it was as if Felka had undergone a spiritual experience. Iverson had shown her something which her mind could not instantly encompass, a problem too large and subtle to be stormed in a flash of intuitive insight. Seeing that, Clavaine again felt guilty about the way he had spoken to Iverson, and knew that he had not completely put aside his doubts about the message Setterholm had left in the ice. But, the riddle of the helmet aside, there was no reason to think that Iverson might be a murderer beyond those haphazard marks. Clavaine had looked into Iverson's personnel records from the time before he was frozen, and the man's history was flawless. He had been a solid professional member of the expedition, well-liked and trusted by the others. Granted, the records were patchy, and since they were stored digitally, they could have been doctored to almost any extent. But then much the same story was told by the handwritten diary and verbal log entries of some of the other victims. Andrew Iverson's name came up again and again as a man regarded with affection by his fellows. Most certainly not someone capable of murder. Best, then, to discard the evidence of the marks and give him the benefit of the doubt. Clavaine spoke of his fears to Galliana, and while she listened to him, she only came back with exactly the same rational counter-arguments that he had already provided for himself. "The problem is," Galliana said, "that the man you found in the crevasse could have been severely confused, perhaps even hallucinatory. That message he left, if it was a message and not a set of random gouge marks he left while convulsing, could mean anything at all." "We don't know that Setterholm was confused," Clavaine protested. "We don't." "Then why didn't he make sure his helmet was on properly? It couldn't have been latched fully, or it wouldn't have rolled off him when he hit the bottom of the crevasse." "Yes," Clavaine said, "but I'm reasonably sure he wouldn't have been able to leave the base if his helmet hadn't been latched." "In which case he must have undone it afterwards." "Yes, but there's no reason for him to have done that, unless..." Galliana gave him a thin-lipped smile. "Unless he was confused. Back to square one, Neville." "No," he said, conscious that he could almost see the shape of something, something that was close to the truth, if not the truth itself. "There's another possibility. One I hadn't thought of until now." Galliana squinted at him, that rare frown appearing. "Which is?" "That someone else removed his helmet for him." They went down into the bowels of the base. In the dead space of the equipment bays, Galliana became ill at ease. She was not used to being out of communicational range of her colleagues. Normally, systems buried in the environment picked up neural signals from individuals, amplifying and rebroadcasting them to other people. But there were no such systems here. Clavaine could hear Galliana's thoughts, but they came in weak, like a voice from the sea almost drowned by the roar of the surf. "This had better be worth it," Galliana said. "I want to show you the airlock," Clavaine answered. "I'm sure Setterholm must have left here with his helmet properly attached." "You still think he was murdered?" "I think it's a remote possibility that we should be very careful not to discount. But why would anyone kill a man whose only interest was a lot of harmless ice worms?" "That's been bothering me as well." "And?" "I think I have an answer. Half of one, anyway. What if his interest in the worms brought him into conflict with the others? I'm thinking about the reactor." Galliana nodded. "They'd have needed to harvest ice for it, which Setterholm might have seen as interfering with the worm's ecology. Maybe he made a nuisance of himself and someone decided to get rid of him." "That would be a pretty extreme way of dealing with him." "I know," Clavaine said, stepping through a connecting door into the transport bay. "I said I had half an answer, not all of one." As soon as he was through, he knew something was amiss. The bay was not as it had been before, when he had come down here scouting for clues. He dropped his train of thought immediately, focusing only on the now. The room was much, much colder than it should have been. And lighter. There was an oblong of chill blue daylight spilling across the floor from the huge open door of one of the vehicle exit ramps. Clavaine looked at it in mute disbelief, wanting it to be a temporary glitch in his vision. But Galliana was with him, and she had seen it, too. "Someone's left the base," she said. Clavaine looked out across the ice. He could see the wake that the vehicle had left in the snow, arcing out toward the horizon. For a long moment they stood at the top of the ramp, frozen into inaction. Clavaine's mind screamed with the implications. He had never really liked the idea of Iverson taking Thelka away with him elsewhere in the base, but he had never considered the possibility that he might take her into one of the blind zones. From here, Iverson must have known enough little tricks to open a surface door, start a rover, and leave without any of the conjoiners realizing. "Neville, listen to me," Galliana said. "He doesn't necessarily mean her any harm. He might just want to show her something." He turned to her. "There isn't time to arrange a shuttle. That trick you did a few days ago, talking to the door, do you think you can manage it again?" "I don't need to. The door is already open." Clavaine nodded at one of the other rovers hulking behind them. It's not the door I'm thinking about.